Hello and welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Jarendaisy.
And we are the Shock Doctors. In this episode, we're going to be discussing the new Conjuring spinoff, The Curse of La Llorona.
Mm-hmm.
And like most of the Conjuring spinoffs, it's, well, I'm going to spoil it for you. It's really not very good. Fortunately, Matt and I were able to see it in an empty theater.
Yeah, we have the Mouse House to thank for that.
Yeah, courtesy of Endgame coming out today or last night, depending on your reckoning. So
you see that guy in the lobby who was dressed up like Cap with the shield and everything?
Yeah, and had about 60 pounds too few muscle mass wise.
Oh, sure, yeah. No, yeah. He was a real kind of a string bean. But my point being, I didn't see any La Llorona cosplay in the lobby. It was puzzling. You'd think that. I don't know. I'm not trying to rag on any movie for going up against Endgame, you know, because they're going to get just trounced. But it was really, I'm grateful to our Disney overlords for vacating the theater for us, because this was a movie that would have been difficult to just bite your tongue during. We were not very conscientious theater goers this time around.
Absolutely not. So, Matt, how about you lay it on us here?
We open in 17th century Mexico, 1673 to be precise, with a little prologue where you see a woman and her two children frolicking gaily in a field, and then she drowns one of them in a creek, and it is every bit as jarring as I am
as
making
your
it
delivery.
Out. Yeah, yeah, and the camera lingers on an amulet that she's wearing around her neck, and one boy, one of her two children, sees the other children, you know, expiring on a riverbank, and attempts to run. The mother reaches out, grabs his arm. Kid screams, "Mama, no!" And then he is yanked out of frame. Smash cut to the title
with a deafening, like,
it is
noise.
Exactly like the title card in Cabin in the Woods. But
but whereas that's played for laughs, this is supposedly straight.
Merely unintentionally funny. And then we cut to exactly 300 years later, to the year, if not the day, Los Angeles, 1973. We're introduced to a family of three, single mother, Anna, and her two children. Anna is a social worker. She goes into work, is getting some flack from her boss. It's introduced through dialogue pretty inelegantly that she's recently widowed. Her late husband was a cop who was killed in the line of duty, and she is dispatched to the apartment of a woman named Patricia Alvarez, who has not reported for some mandated something or other. They haven't checked in on her in a while, so they pay her a visit.
Yeah, it's clear that something ain't quite right when they get the...
What gave you that impression, Jim?
Well, it could be all of the dark and the candles, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
So Patricia opens the door, but she's got the chain up. And Anna, to her own chagrin, has a cop with her, as ordered by her boss, but gets him to stay outside, at least at first, while she mm-hmm. goes in to talk to Patricia. And yeah, she walks in. There appear to be no electric lights on. It's just a metric shit ton of candles, lit mm-hmm. candles.
She comes upon a locked door upon which is etched any number of just a kind of melange of teeth and eyes, I guess, just kind of a Lovecraftian thing. And she tries to get the door open because she's looking for the children. They're nowhere to be seen. Patricia insists that they're safe wherever they are, but she's being kind of squirrely.
But she also has a key dangling on a chain from her neck.
Yes,
and we know this because there's at least four close-up shots of it.
Yeah, very conspicuous.
And in case we missed it the first three times. Eventually, Patricia gets agitated and can't get Anna to leave because Anna's trying to do her job. And so Patricia pounces on her with what looks like a hatchet. Some kind of hand axe.
Yeah, I mean, considering I couldn't really get a clean look at the would-be murder implement, you know, considering how many shots there were setting up the key, you'd think there'd be one establishing what the peril in this situation actually is.
Nah.
But it's a moot point because then the cop barges in and intercedes, separates the two of them. They get the spooky door open, and there are two kids huddling in this broom closet, essentially, and they both want the door shut again. They They say, she'll hurt us. And Anna says, no, no, she won't.
Yeah, the movie spends like 5 minutes playing the pronoun game.
Yes.
Obviously, all the social workers think she means mom when in fact it's La Llorona.
Which is, I guess, why La Llorona appears on the basis of this movie to only antagonize single mothers. There's no, I don't know. So later that night, the two boys who have been liberated from the closet, they've been shown to have burn marks on their wrists, look like big cigar burns or something. And they're in bed. They're jump scared by a nosy janitor. It's probably the most weak sauce jump scare in the movie, although I may end up recanting that as we plow through this synopsis. One of them, a boy's name is Tomas, he gets out of bed in this kind of somnambulistic trance and starts sleepwalking down the hallway. His brother goes after him.
In a really like interminable sequence of shots, which is just Carlos is at one end of the hallway and Tomas is standing at the other end, and then he walks out of frame, and they do this 3 or 4 times.
Yeah, and then the brother, who isn't in a stupor, sees a puddle of tears on the floor. There's a kind of stock sounding like plink plink, like a dripping faucet kind of noise, and he looks up and they get La Llorona'd, essentially snatched away.
Well, don't forget the first instance of the broken mirror meme.
Yeah, I hadn't forgotten. That's worth mentioning, actually. There's a wall-mounted mirror, and they see La Llorona's reflection in it, and the mirror cracks, which is actually the most startling moment in the whole sequence, just because, I mean, having seen it once, you expect it to happen every other time, which it does. It recurs throughout the movie. But yeah, I mean, there's not like a scare chord accompanying it. It's just the glass cracks, and then they get spirited away.
Yeah, and rather than waiting for a while to give us like a full blast shot of La Llorona as visible as possible, the movie just does it right now. We're like 12 minutes in, and the movie already starts blowing its wad in terms of showing us the monster.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to complain more about the creature design after the break, but they really blow it. She looks just like any other fucking lady demon in any of these Conjuring adjacent movies, or just, you know, the whole, well, we'll get to it when we get to it.
Yeah.
Anna? Is that her name? I didn't just like see her across the room. Anna, is that you? Anna is called into a crime scene. The boys have been found drowned under like an overpass by a river.
The LA River that that raging body of water that definitely has enough water in it to drown people all the time.
Well, I mean, you know, La Llorona makes do with what she has. That's another recurring theme. It's that any body of water is immediately suspect. The grieving mother, Patricia, shows up screaming, you know, mis hijos, wheels on Anna and says, this is your fault. I tried to protect them. Anna says, protect them from who? Patricia says, La Llorona. And Anna has brought her own children to this active crime scene, I guess because she didn't want to leave them at home unattended.
Yeah, because she got called. This is the middle of the night. She got called by this detective. Presumably his name is Cooper. They call him Coop.
Mm-hmm.
And it's never explicitly stated, but I think this is the dead husband's partner.
Yeah, he opens every other sentence with, if there's one thing I learned from working with your
husband, or yeah, right, yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he's called her to this crime scene, and I guess, yeah, she didn't want to leave her kids alone. So, but she does leave them alone, just closer.
Yeah, exactly.
In the car.
So right, exactly. They're catching some Z's in the back seat, and the boy gets up and goes for just a jaunt, I guess.
Yeah, a stroll. Well, yeah. He hears somebody crying.
Yeah, you know, go figure.
Yeah, go figure. And so
he's not very street smart, you know, if you hear someone just like weeping in an alley.
You don't go check it out. You don't do that.
Yeah, plus like, I don't mean to give the kid a hard time. What is this, your first crime scene? Like, yeah, okay, it probably is. But like, yeah, there's going to be some grief, some public demonstrations of mourning by this. It's a fucking active crime scene. I don't know. What do you want from me?
Yeah.
So he hears some crying in an alley. He goes to investigate. sees La Llorona. She lunges at him, grabs his wrist, leaves burn marks there where her fingers grazed his skin.
Now, I don't want to pass by this moment without acknowledging the fact that we've complained about this in relation to every James Wan-adjacent Conjuring universe, whatever the fuck, film, most specifically The Nun. But one of the most irritating tricks in the bag of James Wan tricks is the jump scare fake out where you think it's going to come from one direction and in fact it comes from another. And yeah, it's so played out at this point that you don't actually think it's going to come from the first direction, mm-hmm, but they keep shooting these as though you do.
Yeah, it's exactly like a bad magic trick. It's just inept sleight of hand. It's like you see him like palming the card and sliding it up his sleeve. Like, it couldn't be more transparent.
Yeah. And in this particular example, the kid, Chris, sees La Llorona and she's walking in his direction, and then she just kind of like dissolves into the darkness. And then, and this is also in the trailer.
Yeah, very prominently.
Like, off to the right, that's where she rushes in from. But the thing that makes this particularly egregious is that there's like a red light that comes up from exactly the direction that she arrives from when she charges him. And it's literally, I don't know, it's signposting it even more egregiously than it's ever been done before.
Yeah, it draws your eye in that direction, which was probably deliberate. Just, I don't see how it could have possibly been an accident. It is ill-advised, though. You want it to come from the...
Yeah, if your gag is already this played out, you don't need to weaken it any further.
It would be completely predictable, even if it hadn't been undermined by its prominent inclusion in the trailer. Although, somehow, mind-bogglingly, every single jump scare in this movie is featured prominently in the trailer.
Just about.
It's just, okay, we'll address that later on. So, the kid is visibly startled when Anna, his mother, gets back to the car, but he says, oh, I'm fine, I was just seeing things, I was just playing make-believe or something like that.
Well, yeah, because he runs away from La Llorona and gets into the car with his sleeping sister.
Yes.
And then, again, this is also in the trailer, mm-hmm, he plays the game of gotta keep the windows rolled up.
Yeah, the movie belabors that point, we will not.
Yeah.
And he hides his wrist wounds. So then Anna goes to the funeral of the two boys and runs into a priest there, Father...
Perez,
yes. And she asks him if he's ever heard of La Llorona. He kind of gives her the skinny, you know, the backstory, the campfire tale. She was a beautiful maiden who fell in love with a soldier or
a wealthy rancher.
Yeah, and he ends up going behind her back to get some strange on the side. And she, in a jealous rage, I think is the exact expression they use, murders her own children and his.
Yeah, their two
yeah
sons, drowns
and,
them.
And then is consumed by grief and drowns herself. And now she is doomed to wander the planet, basically menacing disobedient children. Like, he frames it as what it actually is, to my understanding, which is, you kids better eat your vegetables or La Llorona's going to get you. You know, right. It really has, like, that kind of boogeyman thing, like, oh, you're going to get put on Santa's naughty list, you're going to get a lump of coal. Like, that has very little to do with the actual mythology as presented in the movie, just, like, on the face of it. So I feel like that kind of undermines La Llorona's presence, that she's just invoked as a way to keep delinquent kids on the straight and narrow. And then, he, you know, so he treats this whole backstory with a lot of gravity, and he gives Anna a rosary and sends her on her way.
Yes.
We then get to, I knew I was going to end up recanting this, where we then get to what is actually the worst jump scare in the movie, the umbrella scene.
Oh, God.
I'll let my colleague field this one, I think.
All right. So, yeah, Sam, Anna's daughter, is just hanging out in their backyard by their pool. It looks like it has recently rained, but it is not raining now. So it makes sense that she's carrying an umbrella, but it does not make sense that she has decided just to open it impromptu.
Yeah, and start twirling it around. I mean, you know, I fidget. Kids get bored. That stands to reason. But, like, the fact that she starts doing it in order to set up a kind of...
a dopey jump scare.
Yeah, a really phoned-in, lame jump scare is, yeah, what irks me, I think. So
she opens up the umbrella, and through the umbrella, it's one of those, like, clear PVC umbrellas.
Mm-hmm.
Through the umbrella, we could see La Llorona standing with her back turned by the pool.
Yeah, they do it a couple times. There's like a screen wipe effect as she like lifts the umbrella. It's like, and then boom, La Llorona's there. And then she like swings it back in the same arc, and then La Llorona's gone. It's like windshield
wipers.
No,
you've got it backwards.
Do
she
I?
Can see it through the umbrella, but if she sweeps the umbrella up, then La Llorona's gone.
You know,
it was basically...
Por que no los dos, as a philosopher once said.
Well, it gives the impression, at least at that juncture, that La Llorona like lives in the umbrella.
Uh-huh.
It's almost like that Superman 2 thing where the villains get trapped inside the the like S label,
the like banishment zone or whatever they call it. Yeah,
right,
no,
the negative zone.
Yeah, hopefully that umbrella shows up in Ed and Lorraine Warren's like haunted doodad room. It's like, and it gets its own spooky origin story.
But yeah, then there's, I don't know, La Llorona pounces or something.
And grabs her wrist. It's the only part of child anatomy that she's apparently interested in. And she leaves the fucking burn marks in the same exact spot every single time.
Yeah, true.
And then she vanishes. This is where we're introduced to Misty, who is the girl's doll, the girl who was just attacked in the backyard.
Yeah. It's not a creepy doll in the style of an Annabelle.
No, it looks like a Raggedy Ann.
Yeah, it's just like a Raggedy Ann.
Like an off-brand Raggedy Ann. And Anna, very pointedly, like she sees the burn marks, says, "Oh, what happened?" The kid says, "I fell." Very unconvincingly.
Like fell into burning coals?
Yeah, fell on a pile of lit cigarettes. Fell into a burning fireworks factory. It's like, yeah, she's been badly maimed. You know, like I would be making a fuss if I'd sustained those injuries. And the mother's just like, "Oh, okay, you know, you should be more careful." You know, it's like you're a social worker. You work, at least you rub elbows with CPS people, if indeed you're not one yourself. It's not 100% clear. But instead she's like, "Well, if you ever get scared, just keep Misty close to you," and she hands her the doll. So that's kind of a Chekhov's gun there.
Yeah.
Coop the cop shows up on her doorstep with a couple pizzas and a case file for Patricia, the mother who's now in custody because she is suspect numero uno in the slaying of her two children. And so he says, "Take a look at the file. Maybe you'll notice something I didn't." Sure enough, she goes through the file. She sees the burn marks on the arms of the two boys, which I think is redundant because didn't she see those
in
person?
Yeah, she saw them already.
With her like own two eyes? Yeah,
I'm pretty sure she saw them the first second she saw the children in the closet.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, so she's inexorably connecting those dots. It's at this point where Coop says something like, "You should come in and talk to Patricia. You know, I think you might get some answers out of her," because apparently she's stonewalling the rest of them. And Anna's like, "Oh no, she won't talk to me. She, you know, she blames me for this somehow. She thinks it's my fault." And Coop says, "Well, you know what my partner always used to say, or you know what, what's, I don't know his name.
Doesn't matter.
You know what your dead husband always used to say." And then Anna says, "Yeah, I know. Angry people love to talk." And I just kind of sat there in a mostly empty theater going like, yeah, you got my number, I guess. Like, that's the premise of this whole undertaking. Angry people love to talk. So we then get another jump scare sequence, also somehow in the trailer. It's like a 9-minute trailer, apparently, where La Llorona pays them another house call, and Anna does her signature move, which is screaming and running at a door that then slams in her face. That happens over and over again in this movie.
Yeah, it happens once in the trailer and probably half a dozen times in the film.
Yeah, the only bit in this scene that I liked, probably the only beat in the whole movie that kind of worked for me, is she's wandering around the house in the middle of the night with a baseball bat, thinking she's got like a home intruder situation on her hands. And she says, "My husband's a cop and he'll be home any minute, so you better clear out of here," something like that. And I was like, oof, that hurts. Like, I don't know if that's just something that she's been in the habit of saying for a long time. I mean, obviously, it's a bluff. Her husband is very much deceased. So then she does go in to talk to Patricia to kind of grill her. And Patricia, floodgates open, basically.
Yeah.
And she says, this is exactly what's going on. La Llorona took my children. Now she's going to take yours. And you know why?
I told her to.
I sicked her on your family like a trained dog. You know, yeah, she says, I didn't pray to God when my children died. I prayed to her. And it's just like a whole, I told her your children weren't eating their vegetables and washing behind their ears and saying their prayers at night. They were not looking both ways before they crossed the street. So now they are forfeit. Their lives are La Llorona's.
Well, it's like the shit that I hate about certain versions of the Slender Man legend.
Mm-hmm. It takes away, or yeah. Like it ascribes human agency to.
Well, yeah, and not an just that, but should be but unknowable. Thinks that Slender Man can be made to do the bidding of a human.
Yeah, that any of these boogeymen can be someone's lackey. Yeah,
in addition to the fact that it ruins the terror, it's also obviously the fodder for tragedy.
Yeah, and what really sinks this whole development is that then Patricia, she frames it like it's some kind of Faustian bargain. Like once La Llorona takes Anna's children, Patricia will get her children back. Like La Llorona is just going to regurgitate them. Yeah.
There you go.
Good as new.
A little slimy, sorry. Yeah. So meanwhile, Chris and Sam are alone at home while their mother is interviewing Patricia. And Chris has another run-in with La Llorona. And long story short, he ends up getting hurled down the stairs.
Mm-hmm. Sprains his wrist.
And
again, wrists. She's just fucking hell-bent.
Just hates fucking wrists, man. Anna bursts in shortly after he's like stumbled down the stairs. And of course, takes him in to see the doctor. And inevitably, as I want to say everyone in the theater, but it was just
us. All two of us. Yeah.
Knew was going to happen. The doctor is checking out the sprain and then sees the finger burns and thinks that it's Anna's doing. And mm-hmm. So the CPS lady has CPS called on her.
Yeah.
Coop shows up and we're meant to believe that it's just him. But then, oh, look, it's Anna's irritating younger coworker that we see in one scene, and we're meant to impute a lot of backstory of tension between
them. It didn't seem like there was that much hostility there. I guess maybe because this is a La Llorona movie, younger women are just innately evil succubi who are only there to wreak havoc on the lives of happy families. But I don't know. So yeah, Coop is kind of a little bit of a Judas, a little bit of a Trojan horse, and then he lets the mean CPS lady into the house, and she's interviewing the kids. And
they play the pronoun game a little bit again.
Exactly, yeah, casting aspersions, and that's basically.
Really, nothing happens.
Nope, like, nothing ever comes of it.
Like, the CPS lady leaves, and she says something along the lines of, you know you probably don't believe this, but I hate being here. And then Coop's just like, whatever's going on, fix it. Thank God for 1970s cops, I guess.
A-plus social work, gang. We then get another jump scare that is also defying all known laws of mathematics, featured prominently in the trailer. Like, the trailer lingers on it, and it's the one in the bathtub. This is a kind of a bedtime ritual that we've seen Anna and her daughter do once before, where Anna kind of gently dunks her daughter's head underwater when she's ready to wash the shampoo out of her hair. And basically, La Llorona steps in to fill those maternal duties while Anna is downstairs, you know, leaving one of her children unattended in a bathtub in spite of everything that they've been through, which is kind of a parenting no-no, even if you aren't being besieged by demons.
Yeah.
But yeah, and then all three of them kind of wrestle with La Llorona, and La Llorona now goes for Anna's wrist because her thirst has not yet been quenched.
Her wrist thirst.
And she, leaves the expected burn marks there, and
it's at this point that Anna elects to consult Raphael, as recommended by Father Perez. He's an ex-priest who's now some kind of shaman, sort of faith healer.
Mm-hmm.
We saw him briefly at the funeral Patricia's two boys.
And then there's another
smoke in mourners' faces.
Yeah, and then there's another throwaway scene where he's in Patricia's now derelict apartment, scraping La Llorona tears into a vial.
Like Egon Spengler.
Yeah, it is. It's like this oily, inky, ichor, like this ectoplasm. Yeah, it's where her tears are very inconsistent. Maybe they like congeal after they've been on the ground long enough. I don't know, but we'll more after the break. I'm sure you're dying to hear my thoughts on that.
Yeah, so Anna goes to consult this guy in his shop, and we're going to touch on this more after the break, but I have to point it out now. This guy gives the most wooden performance I think we've maybe seen to date in a film we've reviewed for the podcast.
Or just a film we've seen. I mean, I was speaking only for myself. I mean, I think he's kind of written that way, but there's like... should be like a little a twinkle in the eye or something just to let you know that he's not like this walking cadaver, you know. It's like he's really like, I got like I walked with a zombie vibes. Like he's, you know, like someone had him under a Haitian voodoo spell or something. Yeah, yeah. He's really just not there.
And you know, it's not as though this guy can't act. I mean, this actor is very much a that guy, and the role that comes to mind specifically is he plays the crazed drug lord Tuco in the first couple seasons of Breaking Bad.
Oh yeah, he acted in that.
Yeah, he's good. Like
I remember him angrily yelling the word pendejo over and over. That's kind of my defining memory of the first season and a half of Breaking Bad.
That's
frankly
fair.
Yeah, no, I mean, so it's I think he's making
just poorly written and
he's
poorly directed,
making a choice, and it's just not working. Yeah, it is just soaringly inert performance.
So he basically gives the rundown, fills in all the gaps that Father Perez did not, explains like, oh, you can't run, she's attached to you, not your house.
That line pissed me off, but that is, I'm actually going to save that for after the break. I always say that and very rarely actually make good on it, but yes, right. More on that later.
Basically he gathers up a bunch of his spells and charms and powders and whatnot.
Eggs.
Right.
Those eggs are like the number one weapon in his arsenal, although he makes shockingly little use of them, as it turns out.
Yeah,
he has this big like Houdini bit where he's showing off some kind of incantation with the eggs, which he had previously been... There's just a shot. He emerges into frame rubbing eggs on the walls of their house, not like yolks, like you know,
like
eggshell,
eggs and shells,
yeah, like
yeah.
Intact eggs. And he turns, you know, the kids, it's like the only moment of wannabe levity in the movie, not the only but the first, and we're like almost an hour in, if not more.
Yeah,
and
the movie's like 84 minutes.
Yeah, right. And so he like turns to them and says, You must think this looks silly or something like that.
And the two kids and Anna are like, yep.
Yeah, and we're like, yep. And the fact that he takes it so seriously just makes it even more farcical. He's like Leslie Nielsen in Airplane or something. like this could have been a really good comic performance, but it's just not, it just doesn't come together. So then he does this weird thing where he makes the eggs vibrate and then explode by chanting some kind of something or other in Spanish.
Of course, they don't spit out regular yolk or egg white. It's more black goop.
Yeah.
So, you know, the bad stuff's going on.
Yeah, and then you never really see the eggs again, except for one, like, gag where he's, like, making an omelet or something, and she, like, thinks it's a magic ritual of some kind, and he says, like, oh, yes, a very, very potent magic breakfast for dinner or something like that. And that's a funny line, but coming, it just sloughs off his mouth. Like a dead bird hitting a windowsill. Not, it was alive before it hit the windowsill. Obviously, the hemispheres of my brain are separating. Let's try to get through this as expediently as possible.
Yeah.
So then there a very protracted pitched battle ensues with La Llorona. That's basically like a 20-minute exorcism. It's not. I was afraid at first that the movie was going to fall into a new rhythm, like a day-night cycle, like so many horror movies do, where you get like night one, La Llorona makes some stuff go bump in the night, and they ward her off, and then the sun rises, and then like you get two more iterations of that gradually raise the stakes. But no, the whole movie basically just plays out over the course of this one kind of protracted night from here on out, pretty much.
Yeah. There's a lot of beats in here. None of them really matter.
No.
So I'll try and give you the highlights. They, at one point, successfully managed to banish La Llorona out to the front porch after she's blown out all the candles in the house.
Mm-hmm.
Because
basically made a mockery of all of his preparations. It really makes him look foolish.
Well, the one thing that he does properly is he's apparently taken his tear goop and consecrated it, turned it into holy water mm-hmm. that he throws at her that pushes her out of the house. So then yeah. he puts down these seeds from this special tree that, I don't know, it doesn't matter. It's something in Mexico.
It matters a little bit because the trees grew by the river where she drowned her children, where La Llorona drowned her children. And so they were the only witness, this kind of like mute witness to her crimes. And so when she's confronted with the wood of that tree or the seeds of that tree, it's like being chastised. She's like, you know, she's humbled in some way. And he also has a cross, big wooden cross hewn from the same genus of tree or whatever.
So after he gets her out on the porch, he drops down like a line of salt, but it's with the seeds mm-hmm. on the door frame, the bottom of the door, and slams the door shut. It's like, don't break this line. And then suddenly they hear La Llorona trying to get in the back door. Or she could come in through the window, or he put them on the windowsill too.
But yeah, there's too many points of ingress to possibly cover all your bases.
So they all run off, and there's a lot of like off screen shouting from Raphael about like get back, demon.
And it's the only time in the whole movie he raises his voice, and he sounds so far away. It just makes you imagine like a slapstick scene happening off camera. Where, you know, he probably takes an egg to the face at one point, knowing him, because I think he's just got eggs on his person at all times.
Meanwhile, Sam, the girl child, has discovered that Misty, her doll, has gone mm-hmm. missing. And sure enough, she finds it sitting on the porch just out of her reach.
Yeah, all but hooked on a fishing line.
Right. She successfully reaches out to grab it. Just as she's doing it, Anna's like, oh, no, don't do it. And sure enough, Sam pulls it back in, but then basically obliterates the fucking line of seeds. Fortunately, La Llorona doesn't come in immediately, but then we segue into a very tedious sequence.
Yeah, so they've restored all their bean barriers to, you know, prevent her from getting into the house, and they're just kind of holed up. They've got a pot of coffee brewing, which for a second I thought was a boiling pot of La Llorona tears, which I thought was like gross, but I'm sure it would put a pep in your step if you actually drank it. Yeah, what ensues made me thought. Yeah, I was about to say made me think that I was having a stroke. Apparently, I'm still having one. It, you know how in modern trailers have been edited this way for a while now. They're constantly fading to black, like every couple seconds, it seems like. Particularly irksome when you're trying to find your seat, you know, if you...
Right.
It's edited exactly like that. It's just...
But it's in the movie.
It's
for
shot
like 3 minutes.
Shot of... Yeah, it's you know, words fail me, obviously. Yeah, it'd be like a shot of Anna with her mug of coffee, fade to black, and then fade in on something else, fade to black. It's like, I thought I was losing consciousness. Like my eyelids were fluttering. And I feel like it was supposed to evoke some kind of dreamy, half-awake feeling, but there's no... there's no... It's just apropos of fucking nothing.
The last shot of this asinine sequence is of the two kids in the closet, because Raphael and Anna have stashed them in the closet a la Patricia and her two kids.
Right. They haven't drawn a bunch of teeth and eyes on the door, which I guess might help their case when CPS breaks in.
Right. And the doors to the closet open, and Chris is like, but again, last shot of it fades to black.
Yeah,
and
oh
then
my God.
The movie goes back to being mm-hmm. you know, fucking normal.
Every time it faded to black, I thought I was going to wake up in an ambulance. what happened? Yeah, it was really... And you know, I never like come after directors for trying something weird or avant-garde. I just feel like this was a case where the guy must have known that he was kind of making boring schlock, and he wanted to spice it up somehow. And I don't know if he just went with his first idea or what the rationale here was, because it's impossible to backwards engineer what the filmmakers must have been thinking. It's one of the most mystifying choices, creative choices, that we've had to deal with on this program.
Yeah. So there's some tussling that goes on. La Llorona and the two children are on the verge of leaving.
Well, no, it's not. It's Patricia who has broken in. La Llorona, because remember, she like sweeps the beans away from the door with her foot.
That's right.
So
I'm trying to get through this as quickly as possible.
It's not working for either of us.
No.
So it wasn't La Llorona who just threw open the doors to the closet. It was Patricia who, we forgot to mention, there's a line some time ago where Coop says, oh, we had to release her. Wasn't enough evidence. So I figured she would re-enter the picture at some point. But yeah, I mean, she's come to basically kick the seeds away from the door and usher it, La Llorona, back into the house to expedite this whole process.
And in fact, even take the kids outside to give them to La Llorona.
Yeah, exactly, because she still thinks that this transaction is going to take place where she's going to have her own children returned to her. And I guess maybe the constant fading to black was supposed to maybe elide the fact that it wasn't La Llorona coming into the house, because you see like a female figure like coming down the hallway. But there's a million other ways they could have done that.
Yeah.
So anyway, Patricia's here and she has a gun and she shoots Raphael and he goes down. It takes it in the shoulder because movies.
Right.
And La Llorona just comes charging through the door and Anna gets knocked into the basement and the door slams shut, which is really La Llorona's favorite.
Yeah. Put Anna behind a locked door.
Yes,
that's,
slam
that's
a door.
Her go-to.
Slam a door in her screaming face.
Yeah. Chris takes his sister upstairs up to the attic, tries to tie down the attic door on a pillar, but he didn't like knot it. He just looped the rope around so La Llorona pulls it open immediately.
A bunch of stuff starts flying around poltergeist style. Some Christmas decorations come to life. You get like a sinister minor key rendition of some novelty,
Jingle Bells or
some dopey. Yeah, some novelty Christmas song.
Yeah. So while La Llorona is basically cornering the children in the attic, Anna has been trying to beat down the basement door to get out, and Patricia, who we've occasionally just seen like close-up shots of her looking nervous and upset, is apparently decided to do the right thing, and she breaks the knob off to get the door open and just says, go. So Anna runs upstairs. At this point, Raphael has sort of roused himself, and he heads upstairs.
And what's transpiring upstairs is that the boy has presented La Llorona with the amulet that she was wearing in the prologue, which we didn't even touch on this. At one point during one of the many, many demon wrestling scenes that comprise the back half of this movie, Anna snatched the amulet from around La Llorona's neck. Now the boy has it. He shows it to La Llorona. La Llorona,
like, de-demonifies.
Yeah, exactly.
Turns into her 1673 self, and it's just kind of like stroking his face.
Appears to believe that these are her children, and then she catches her reflection in a body-length mirror that's been stored in the attic.
Looks demon-y again.
And the glass breaks.
Of course.
Naturally. It was only surprising the first time.
And I don't know. A couple more things happen, but basically this whole thing ends with Raphael sliding Anna the special cross.
Yep. Raphael with the assist.
And Anna just straight up stabs La Llorona with it like she's a vampire.
Yeah, she stakes La Llorona in the heart, and then La Llorona turns into a goo tornado.
a goo tornado, like, She's a goopy blade vampire. Like,
and they were already pretty goopy, at least in the first one.
Right. Well, it looks like bad CG, but it's supposed to be like ashes and flame and stuff, and you see like a skeleton. But this, it's just like she's disintegrating and crumbling, and you see the skeleton side eventually, but it's all just black goop.
Yeah, here's like skeleton like spins around like a whirligig and falls to pieces, and that's the end of that.
Yeah, and the movie ends with Raphael getting packed off in a taxi and having what would in theory be like heartwarming banter with Anna and her children, except he's still just not
a reanimated corpse. Yeah.
And he drives
off.
Well,
got to get back to the morgue before the spell wears off.
And yeah, the movie ends with Anna seeing a puddle on the ground and looking ominously into the puddle. And then it's over. Like, what are we supposed to be scared of the puddle now? Really?
Yeah, because there's one puddle of La Llorona tears that looks like water, and it's in the hallway scene when Patricia's two sons are snatched. But every other time we see La Llorona tears throughout the movie, it's that black Icarus substance, that Ghostbusters shit. So yeah, it's they have not prepared this final what if moment before the credits roll. It's just doesn't land like so many things in this movie.
Well, anyway, we've belabored the synopsis long enough. We'll take our break, and we'll come back with our thoughts in a moment.
Mm-hmm.
Father, can you help us?
The church works with people who specialize in situations like this.
Get to La Llorona.
Is she coming?
She's already here.
What do we do?
Hello, listeners. It's Jim, here as always during the break to tell you some stuff you probably already know. Please follow us on Twitter at Shock Doctors Pod, on Facebook at facebook.com/shockdoctorspod, or check us out on iTunes. The podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. If you've got an idea for a movie you'd like us to check out, feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at shockdoctorspod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
We are facing an evil. It has no bounds.
And we are back. So, Matt, let's kick things off.
Okay. If you insist. I went into this movie with pretty low expectations, and it fell beneath them.
It limboed under that benchmark.
Yeah, as you've surely gathered. I took issue with all the stuff that I complained about before the break. I think that Raphael is hewn from the same wood of the tree that grew on the banks of the river where La Llorona killed her children. I think that the dialogue is at best functional and never good. Except for the one bit about my husband's a cop, you better get out of here. And that's only okay. You know, it still could have been framed better and probably delivered better, although I think Anna's performance is fine. I got to say, I didn't expect great things from this movie just because it is another Conjuring joint. But I got to admit, there's something about the fact that La Llorona is an actual folkloric figure that feels like there was more potential being squandered here than, say, with the Nun, or
where it's literally just a throwaway monster from like an early scene in The Conjuring 2.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like, it was probably a mistake to bring in the stuff about how she's used to chide naughty children, because unless you go with that all the way and make that the actual threat that she poses, which they very much don't. Instead, La Llorona is just kind of a hitman.
Kinda.
But it's not actually clear that she goes after Anna's family because Patricia wills it. It's not because, I mean, Patricia's obviously delusional. Then the question becomes, how delusional? It's not a very interesting question.
Yeah. I think it purely comes down to the fact that Anna and her children were present at the crime scene with the two kids that La Llorona just killed.
Probably.
Like if they had not gone to that crime scene, I don't think Patricia's exhortations to La Llorona would have come to anything necessarily.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that whole revenge aspect just falls flat for me because you've already got the La Llorona backstory about a woman scorned who becomes homicidal in the blink of an eye. And then you have Patricia basically doing the same thing beat for beat, except then she becomes contrite and kind of reforms herself. I guess so, kind of a little redemption arc there, but yeah, I just feel like there's I think just one too many women in this movie who become crazed harpies when they're in mourning. You know, it's just kind of like that's already baked into the backstory. You don't need another character to sell that slightly odious idea. I'm sure that's what they were going for, is that it's like, oh, it's cyclical. Fuck you. No, I mean, just let what I was getting at before is that La Llorona being an actual boogeyman who was not invented by James Wan or fucking Lee Wannell or whoever else could have made her innately scarier, but it's just they just screw the pooch, and first and foremost because she looks boring as all get out. You know, she looks exactly like the bride in Insidious 2, or she looks basically exactly like the nun.
Yeah, it's the same. It's the white face, mm-hmm, with the black ichor coming out of the eyes and the mouth.
Yeah, and the CGI python jaws that can dislocate and get all stretchy.
I think that effect, in fact,
has never looked worse.
Yeah, it has reached a new low in this film, because it literally just looks like the mouth falls open. Like if there had been like a clang sound effect, I don't think it would have made it any dumber.
Yeah, no, she looks like the ghouls from I Am Legend in that respect.
Yes,
that's what I would liken it to, more than anything.
This is a very obscure throwback, but there was that shitty like horror action film Legion, where
Paul Bettany
plays the Archangel Michael, and there's like a possessed old lady who like wheels around in the trailer and in the film, and her mouth drops.
Yeah, so I remember that.
No one will remember that, but that's what I thought of.
Yeah, no, I haven't seen Legion. Actually, haven't seen I Am Legend either, but those monsters are just kind of like legendarily shoddy looking.
Yes, it's true.
And yeah, La Llorona is just a complete wet blanket.
Oh, and the yellow irises too.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, I like conceptually that she was a human woman who died under tragic circumstances and is now a ghost, you know, a vengeful ghost. It's better than it just being a demon that's pretending to be something interesting,
yeah,
which is what happened in The Nun. But that's all like pre-production stuff. Like the execution is still very poor.
Yes.
The fact that she has to drown all her victims ends up hobbling the film in a couple ways. One of which is kind of a weird rant, I feel, but what you would expect from a movie like this, single mother, two kids in a horror movie, usually, almost always, families in movies like this are kind of blue collar and just scraping by. And there's some visual shorthand for that in this movie. Like she's constantly feeding them these kind of unappetizing looking TV dinners,
yeah,
or like stale looking pizza and stuff like that. And she's working an unglamorous job, and, you know, and she's the sole breadwinner obviously, cause her husband is dead. And they're in,
they have a pool.
They have a fucking enormous pool in the backyard that looks well-maintained. If the pool just had a bunch of leaves floating in it or looked like it could maybe
use a little bit scummy,
a new batch of chlorine, that would be fine. But it looks pristine, and it doesn't jive at all with everything else that we're... I mean, they live in a big house, but it's you know, it's... If they'd been, like, a well-to-do family that had fallen on hard times, that would be one thing. And I'm not even saying that every nuclear family in a movie like this needs to be, you know, living paycheck to paycheck. That's just kind of how it's normally done, because it's a quick, easy way to engender sympathy.
Right.
And it seems like this movie is trying to do that, except, oops, La Llorona has to drown her victims, therefore there's a fucking big pool in the backyard. Yeah, that was a big incongruity for me. Really threw me.
Yeah, that was pretty silly. It's strange, because on the one hand, yes, it seems like La Llorona needs to drown all her victims, but on the other hand, if that's truly the case, the kids being up in the attic, there's no water up there.
Just give her enough time to cry herself a...
cry herself a puddle.
Yeah, a puddle of sufficient depth.
Yeah, the kids were not actually in danger up there as long as she didn't take them downstairs to the tub.
Their wrists are in imminent danger, because that's all she does, is she grabs you by the wrist and drags you to the nearest body of water, which is... It's a shame we didn't get that montage of her just kind of, I don't know, hauling the... Yeah, I don't know. I was about to make a gag at the expense of the two slain kids from the first act, Patricia's boys, but that actually doesn't really sit well with me either, because they're set up to be way more expendable than Anna's kids. And I feel like dead kids are inevitable in a movie about La Llorona, yeah. But there's something about the way that they're offed that just felt a little callous to me. And then Patricia, another performance that really didn't work for me. She shows up at the crime scene crying, you know, mis hijos, all that stuff that I got into in the first half or three quarters of this recording. And let me tell you, it's not exactly Mrs. Kintner on the dock in Jaws. Like, it's not a moment that's actually going to bring a tear to anybody's eye. It's her whole, like, grieving mother routine is just not very credible, and it may or may not be the actress's fault. I really don't know. It comes up again when Anna comes to question her when she's still in police custody, and Patricia's sitting on the other end of the table being like, I feel nothing anymore. You've taken everything from me. But instead of delivering those lines flatly and looking checked out, like, she actually feels nothing. Like, she's actually kind of got this vacuous, hollow thing going on. She looks just kind of stern and ticked off.
Well, and the other thing is, like, 12 seconds after she says that, she starts thinking about what happened to her kids and she starts getting emotional again.
Yeah, but not even... It seems like she's reacting to someone cutting her off in traffic, I guess, is what I'm trying to get at. Like, she's angry, but it looks like road rage. It doesn't look like, I don't know. I mean, playing a parent who's lost a child is, like, one of the hardest roles you can give an actor if you haven't experienced that loss yourself. That's why I try not to give Dale Midkiff too much shit for Pet Sematary, even though I really want to. But... It's just, yeah, I mean, it's written badly, performed not especially well, and honestly, Anna, the actress who plays Anna, I don't know her name off the top of my head, is the only one who emerges more or less unscathed, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I think that's...
And I got the padre, whatever his name is.
Father Perez.
Yeah, Father Perez is okay, but he says every line exactly the same way, you know, with a lot of gravitas. He's just there as an exposition machine. Right. I was hoping he would show up for the exorcism.
Would have been
way better than the faith healer that they roped in. But yeah, no, it's just, alas, he had better shit to do. On that note, we've complained before about how the connective tissue in this Conjuring cinematic universe is always the worst part of every movie.
Such weak shit.
It was really bad in The Nun. The one in this movie is the most perfunctory, blink and you miss it, limp dick fan service you could ever hope to see. You've seen Annabelle. I haven't. The first one. So why don't you lay it out? I've kind of given the game away.
Yeah,
but,
I mean,
you know,
there's not much to lay out, and I also don't remember the film very well. But basically, Annabelle... the film ends with a confrontation in, like, a hotel, and like this film, it's a period piece. I think it might be 60s or something. It's earlier, but it ends in kind of a grimy LA hotel, and the reference to Annabelle in this film is just Father Perez, who does appear in that film. I had forgotten this.
Mm-hmm.
Says, I didn't used to believe in hokey stories like this, but then I had an experience which changed my feeling on the subject, and there was this doll, and then it's just like archive footage of him walking, carrying the doll out of the hotel.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. That's the only thing that ties this to Annabelle, which is already, it's a fucking prop from the first Conjuring film.
Yeah, right. And the thing is, if Father Perez was a memorable character who, like, audiences could be counted upon to remember, he could have just said, yeah, I used to be a demon agnostic, but then I experienced something that made me change my mind. Wink. And then the audience would be like, oh, that's an Annabelle reference. But no one cares about Annabelle. So they have to throw in the shot to make the connection explicit. And that's what makes it so tiresome, you know, is that if this were like an MCU movie, they throw stuff like that out of the audience all the time, and you're just expected to either keep up, or if you miss it, no big deal. Here it's like, yeah, they have to belabor it, because when did Annabelle come out? 2014?
Yeah,
a fucking eternity ago. Because there aren't quite enough of these movies for that shit to fly, and they're also not consistently good enough for that shit to fly. It's funny because it's the only, like financially speaking, it's the only cinematic universe that's kind of working other than the big one. The Conjuring movies have pretty much all done gangbusters. We'll see how La Llorona fares going up against Endgame. But yeah, it's just in terms of actual cohesiveness, there's no design and there's no, they have no staying power, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. And you know, the thing about all of these movies that fall under the Conjuring umbrella, they couldn't make up their fucking minds about whether La Llorona was even going to be part of that big happy family. There's something just terribly arbitrary about it. There's a bunch of reasons that the Insidious movies couldn't be in the Conjuring chronology because, you know, they share too many actors for one thing. But like, they might as well be, you know, like they'd be right at home there. It's all the fucking same. It's all just this big slurry of undifferentiated James Wan-y stuff. And I guess, actually, I'm going to read you, this is per Wikipedia. Despite claims that it is the sixth installment in the Conjuring universe, The Curse of La Llorona is actually a standalone film that references the Conjuring universe.
What does that mean?
I don't understand that distinction. It has four footnotes. Four hyperlinks that where you can, you know, continue to do research, I guess. Yeah, no, it's so...
That doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, that kind of waffling is just tedious, and I...
Ugh.
Yeah, no, either...
Gross.
Yeah, it's bad.
Speaking of bad, I wanted to talk a little bit more about the bathtub scene with Sam and his daughter, which is to say the scene where she gets bathed by La Llorona,
mm-hmm.
because it is very dopily executed.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. With the hands?
With the hands.
Go on.
So, as we've explained, this ritual that Anna and her daughter have is Anna sort of gently massages her hair and her scalp with the shampoo, and then when that's all done, gently dunks her under the water to get the shampoo out. And so... in this instance, La Llorona with her nasty corpse fingers is massaging Sam's scalp and getting the shampoo up in a lather and such. And then, as is custom, Sam says, "Rinsing!" And then she is dunked. And first of all, there are so many things wrong with this, but first of all, the film... cannot decide whether it wants La Llorona to be visibly responsible for this or not, because there are certain shots where you can see La Llorona standing over the bathtub holding Sam underwater, and then there are shots where it looks like it's semi in her head or you can't really see La Llorona. So that's stupid. I don't know why it can't make up its mind about that,
right?
Why there's that ambiguity. The next thing that's very dumb is that there's a shot. I mean, there's a few shots like this, but one in particular that I'm thinking of where it's like a handheld shaky cam shot of under the water from the side where you see the like practical La Llorona hands and they just look stupid.
It looks like a Halloween costume. It's way too tactile. For a monster that is mostly very spectral throughout the movie, in that shot, the hands look like something out of an 80s Evil Dead movie, which would normally be a compliment. But here, it's just completely visually inconsistent.
Yeah. And then there's also a shot of, it's like a wide shot from around the doorway of La Llorona just... standing over the bathtub, holding her under the water, looking like a statue.
Looking
almost.
Yeah, looking like she's just cashing a paycheck. Like she's just
fucking standing there.
Like she's bored to be there.
And then there's also a shot from underwater.
Yes, that's the one I was right.
Up into La Llorona's face, and La Llorona could not look more bored if she tried.
Yeah, just completely disaffected. Yeah, I mean, that's her whole... We've harped on about the failings of her monster design, but they really... My biggest beef with it, honestly, is that they don't do enough with that veil, because her face is constantly, it's like flying up like Marilyn Monroe's skirt
in the seven year itch.
It's just constantly flying off of her face so she can do the played out I Am Legend or Exorcism of Emily Rose or Legion scream face thing. Yeah, stretchy mouth. And we've seen stretchy mouth over and over and over again. If I saw that in a nightmare, I wouldn't be afraid of it. You know, it's like the veil is not actually used to conceal anything, and I think that that's a big missed opportunity. They're not playing to the strengths of her design,
which are few.
They're just putting her right into the same circular hole that all of their monster pegs get forced into in this fucking franchise. It's it's lame.
Yeah. And as a final note on this scene, it ends with Anna once again having a door slammed into her face as she's running toward it screaming.
Mm-hmm.
She gets it open and has to drag both of her children out of the bathroom, successfully does it, and then as they hurry back downstairs, the camera lingers on the entryway to the bathroom, and for some reason it's dark in there now, even though there was a light on before. Whatever. It's dark, and it's just, it lingers there for so long that we were convinced that the camera was going to get jump scared in the absence of any other actors.
Yeah, there's a couple shots that linger too long in this movie. There's an earlier one of, I think, a hospital.
Yes.
There's like an exterior shot of a crane shot or a helicopter shot of a hospital
drone
at night.
Drone shot.
Gotta be. I know. I'm an old curmudgeon. That is just here to stay. It like takes its coat off. It puts its feet up. It gets really comfy. And then finally cuts to the next scene. It's like the longest establishing shot. Not literally the longest, but the most conspicuously overlong establishing shot that I've seen in some time. Really overstays its welcome. Something I made a point of...
saving.
Yeah, something I made a point of singling out during the plot synopsis that I want to return to now just briefly is this line when they're in the faith healer's shop. And Anna says, oh, I'm going to take the kids to a hotel for a couple nights. And he says, why? She'll follow you wherever you go. You know, she's not haunting the house. She's haunting your family. This is the kind of line that made sense more than 10 years ago. Like when the first Paranormal Activity came out, I remember it had that whole song and dance in it.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter if you move, the house isn't haunted. Because then the trope was, the question on every audience member's mind was, well, why don't they just go get out of the house? So every horror movie has had to deal with that. Not every horror movie, every paranormal, spooky ghost movie has had to address that one way or another. But I really feel like we've moved past that as a society. Like La Llorona is clearly set up to work in a particular way. She is gunning for those kids, their tasty, delicious wrists, specifically, their charbroiled wrists. And it never even occurred to me that the house was haunted. I don't think that would cross anyone's mind, but they still feel the need to lampshade it just because I guess they're catering to like would-be nitpickers in the audience. Like they don't want to get a CinemaSins ding, you know, for some kind of plot hole. But it's like that kind of plot hole maintenance is so unwelcome. I can't even begin to tell you how little patience I have for that kind of thing. There's just no call for it. Of course she's not haunting the house. Why would she?
Yeah, there's nothing special about the house to her.
Right. Except that it has a pool, which I guess makes it advantageous.
Yeah, it's convenient. That's the only thing that's special about the house. And the other thing that bothers me about that line in the context of what happens later is Raphael goes to great lengths to banish her out of the house.
From the house.
Specifically.
Yeah, from the property.
Now, granted, you could make the argument that's just because they're in the house, and if she's banished out of the house, they have some breathing room. But still, it's just something about that rings very silly.
Exactly, because then the long exorcism battle sequence plays into a lot of poltergeisty kind of Zelda Rubinstein, this house is clean kind of tropes.
Yeah.
And I thought the house wasn't the problem, but, you know, fuck me for keeping track. Yeah, I don't know. It's not to keep harping on about the whole cinematic universe Conjuring project, but you know, especially because I went on a similar rant back when we reviewed The Nun, but
ages ago.
A very long time ago. But you know, forgive the pun, but what the fuck is the end game here? Like, what is the there's no crossover event that's going to justify all of these stories happening within a certain proximity of one another. It's not like there's going to be some kind of Suicide Squad team up thing where the Nun, Valak, you know, Marquis of Snakes or whatever his fucking name is, Archduke of Komodo Dragons, has to team up with Annabelle, who has a vendetta against La Llorona, who it's just never going to happen. There's never even going to be a Freddy versus Jason, Alien versus Predator style showdown movie. Even that would be something. But it's
yeah, there's no unifying big bad either. Like, if it was like the MCU, for example, and you just have all of these, frankly, disposable villains. I mean, everybody knows yes. that the villains are the least effective part of the MCU.
Generally, yeah.
Say you've got all these disposable villains, Valak and La Llorona and whatever the other fucking one you just mentioned was that I've already forgotten because it doesn't matter. Yeah. Annabelle, thank you. Let's say all of those are disposable. It's not like the Warrens are going to team up with Anna and her kids and the kids from the Annabelle prequel and whatever else. Fight some overarching villain, because there isn't one.
No, there isn't.
What could there be?
I mean, they could all be working for Satan, I guess, if you really wanted to go like
yep.
Amityville
yep.
horror with it.
They're gonna go fight the devil.
Honestly, if it turns out that Lucifer himself has been pulling the strings this entire time, that'd be like a cop-out, but it might be kind of funny. I hope this bit doesn't come back to bite us, because we saw a trailer in advance of La Llorona for Annabelle Comes Home, and it seems like that's trying to do a little bit of franchise expansion, where like it seems like the conceit of that movie is some good for nothing instigating character like blunders into the Warren's doom closet with all their haunted relics, and she just basically runs into the disaster factory and accidentally throws every single switch, like just sets just like Jumanjis all of these demons into the world for them to sign. Like, it's an Annabelle movie, clearly, just based on the title and the marketing, but it seems like maybe it's going to try to get a couple more genies out of the bottle. I don't know if that's actually going to rope all these movies together. I said when we reviewed The Nun, it's like herding cats. They don't want to have anything to do with each other. They're running away from each other as fast as they possibly can. And plus, they take place across multiple decades. You know, it'd be like characters from the Star Wars prequels hanging out with characters from the new trilogy. It just doesn't compute.
Yeah, you're gonna have to age up some people.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's a waste of time, kinda. I mean, some of them have been good, but I mean, what's the high watermark here? The Conjuring, like the first one?
Yeah. I mean, it's gotta be.
Yeah, I think indisputably. Maybe. Oh, fuck me. I just thought that the Ouija movies were part of this. The Ouija movies are not part of this, but they might as well be. I almost was like, oh, the Ouija prequel was okay. The Ouija prequels has, no, fuck it. It might as well be, right? Like, if I pulled up Wikipedia right now, it would be like, actually, the Ouija movies aren't part of the Conjuring universe. They're standalone movies that merely reference the Conjuring universe. 8 citations. It's so, just so very, very arbitrary.
Much though I'm loath to come to the defense of James Wan, the original Ouija film is one of the 15 or 20 worst films that I've seen out of coming up, I think, on about 4,000.
Yeah. Oh, it's lousy. Don't get
so
me wrong.
Putting that on his plate is too much even for him.
Yeah, yeah. No. I'm sure he wouldn't go anywhere near that one. But
yeah, The Conjuring, I guess, out of all the films, because the direct sequel to The Conjuring was just kind of okay. And I guess the second Annabelle film, which is a prequel, I think.
I think that's probably what I was thinking of when I roped a Ouija prequel.
Well, yeah, because the Annabelle prequel and the Ouija prequel both were vastly superior to their predecessors.
Yeah, they were marked improvements.
/ successors.
One was Mike Flanagan. The other was the Lights Out guy.
Yeah, Mike Flanagan did the Ouija prequel.
Yeah, and then David F. Sandberg did the Annabelle prequel. Anyway, welcome aboard, Mike Flanagan. You know, we'll get Haunting of Hill House in the mix too, because we might as well, right? Like,
let's just make every horror movie part of the same universe.
I really feel like it's like The Stuff. It's just this creeping, all encompassing malaise that's eventually going to swallow the entire genre. And I think that's why I kind of go into these reviews with a lot of hostility. But La Llorona was just very bad, in addition to playing into some of my prejudices.
As Matt said at the outset, he went in, and so did I, with very low expectations. And this film dramatically failed to clear that low bar.
Yeah. So if you want to watch something better, maybe check out The Stuff. Larry Cohen is quite good. And the actual recommendation that I have for y'all is, I kept thinking about an Iranian film called Under the Shadow. Go watch it. I think it's still on Netflix. Specifically, this is mostly for my co-host's benefit, the bit with the tablecloth where she like wreathes herself in the, sure. You know, I got the distinct impression during like the third act of this movie. Because I've been fearing for a while, like, when is Under the Shadow going to get its shitty American remake? And now it doesn't need one, because The Curse of La Llorona exists. I even thought that they were going to do that when the doll was stolen, because the demons in Under the Shadow, if they have something that's precious to you, then they have a connection to your, then they can persist in haunting you, and that's kind of how the haunting perpetuates itself. I thought that when Misty, off-brand Raggedy Ann, was stolen, that that's where that was going, but that's because I was fantasizing about a better horror movie that I watched once and wishing that this one was more like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, Under the Shadow, pretty sure it's still on Netflix. Check it out.
Even if it's not, find it. Find it somewhere.
Go see Endgame. I don't know. I haven't even seen it yet. It's got to be better than this.
Almost inevitably.
Can't wait for La Llorona to join the Avengers, you know, with presumably Iron Man and or Captain America getting out of their contracts. Somebody's got to fill that void.
Well, this has been another episode of the Shock Doctors podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese, and I have one more anecdote, actually, which is that the one boon that this movie has introduced into my life is that I have a very whiny dog at home, and she will wander the hallways at night occasionally whimpering and whinnying. And not whinnying, that's what horses do. I haven't recovered from my stroke fully, obviously. But she'll, you know, go down the hall at night, whimpering and carrying on, and I've started referring to her as La Llorona, and you know, like, oh, mis hijos, she wakes, you know, that kind of thing. So it's like, this movie has enabled me to make fun of my dog, and that's been a good time. So I'm glad it exists, but I got that from the trailer, you know.
Right.
So there's no need to actually go see it. Anyway, he's Jim Smith. I'm Matt Gerandese. We will see you next time.
And we are the Shock Doctors.
Adios.
As always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from The Curse of La Llorona, official trailer HD, uploaded by Warner Brothers Pictures. All rights reserved. Our next episode will be up on Sunday, May 19th, and since we have a bit of a break in the horror release schedule, we'll be discussing a little piece of late 2000s schlock, The Haunting of Molly Hartley. See you then.